You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
Divert auxiliary power to the rear deflector shield.
We definitely do.
Since when do you know how to fly? 190 years old? You look great.
Chewie, get in. I'll help Ando.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club. So excited to be here tonight, coming at you from the largest cape closet I have ever seen. Actually, it makes a pretty good recording studio, I gotta say. The sound bounces off the capes and, you know, it diffuses that. It's really nice to be here. Lando's got a great collection. But I couldn't do this show alone, as we're going to be talking about Solo, a Star Wars story. And I'm really excited to have here to talk about Solo none other than Christy Morris.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back. I'm so excited to talk about this movie. I can't stand it.
John texted me, and the spoiler alert, John Mills is here. Hi. He texted me earlier and he's like, countdown. And we've been ready. So, John, it's contractual with the 602 Club. If there's a new Star Wars movie, you have to be on the show.
Here's hoping people like my appearance better this time, Matt. Here's hoping for that one.
Well, before we dive in real quick, of course, make sure you find the show on iTunes at itunes.com/TrekFM, or you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. But if you do happen to be over there on Apple Podcasts, hit us up with a star rating review. You know, we got a new one recently. It was super cool to get one. It happened to be 5 stars, but give us your rating. Let us know what you think with a written review, and we'll call you out in the show. Find us on Twitter at TrekFM. Make sure you're following us there so you can check out everything the network is doing. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, which is really important. Like us there because you'll see all the shows that are coming out. We've got the listeners only discussion group over on Facebook, which is called the Babel Conference. Now, if you want to get into the group, it is a members only group, so you have to be asked to let in. So go over to Facebook, type in Babel into the search field, and one of us can let you in. Or if you're on the website at trek.fm, any of the show pages, hit discussion on the menu bar there, and that'll bring you over there as well. Of course, as I just mentioned, Trek FM is a great place to visit, so you can see all the shows we're doing, kind of peruse the old catalog of what shows did years back. You know, I mean, gosh, this is episode 184, but with all the supplementals, we're actually over 200 shows. So, I mean, there's so much that we've done. Each and every show here on the network has at least a catalog of usually about 100 shows, if not more. So much to check out. And if you want to send us an email, go to the website at trek.fm/contact. Choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that will come to me and then any of the hosts that are on that week, and we can talk to you about whatever it is that we talked about that week, which obviously this week we're talking about Solo. And I wanted to talk to you guys. I wanted to know real quickly, because we have so much to discuss in this movie. It's a Star Wars movie, so it's always a big show. But, you know, with it being one of the story films, before Solo, where were you coming into this? Were you excited about a Solo movie? Did you want this movie in the first place? How did you walk into the theater with this one? What about you, Christy?
So I will say I didn't see this one coming as the next standalone after Rogue One. I wasn't sure if they would go the direction of an Obi-Wan movie first or something totally different. But I'm glad that we got this movie because honestly, something I had hoped to learn at some point in film form was how Han became who he was in the original trilogy. So I love that we got the story of how he gets the Millennium Falcon, you know, the story of how he does the Kessel Run. And, you know, even though it may seem a little bit cheesy, me as a fan, I feel like a lot of fans were probably in the same place. So I'm glad that we got it. But going in, I really was looking at it as a fun ride and not trying to get my expectations too high, because I feel like that's something I reserve more for the main saga films. And it was a little difficult coming back down from The Last Jedi. You know, I feel like there were some objections I had to that more than I had had to some of the others, mainly with how Snoke was dealt with. But I think going into Solo, like I said, with just looking for a fun ride, was the perfect way to come in, because then I left more than satisfied after.
I was very skeptical about whether Solo would be a film even worth seeing. You know, I knew I was going to see it because it was a Star Wars film. I made jokes about it, much like everybody else on the internet, where it was like, oh, geez, look at all the production troubles. This is really going nowhere fast. And, you know, just sort of like cracking wise about it and stuff. And, you know, looking at the movies that were coming out around it, I was like, oh, my gosh, they're just nuts. They should push this back and all of that stuff. And, you know, getting caught up in all the, you know, behind the scenes stuff that, you know, was garnering headlines and everything. And so after I saw the second trailer or the third trailer, whichever one it was, and then when I saw it on the big screen before Infinity War, was really when the needle truly moved, where I was like, this looks pretty slick. I'm cautiously optimistic here. So I went into it and I took the family at the first showing, and I was like, you know what, guys, you know, the most important thing to me is just that we're all here and we're gonna have a good time, and let's just, you know, have some candy and popcorn and just see what happens.
So you're saying you blew like $200?
Yeah, easy. but like I was fairly subdued going in, hopeful but subdued. I was like, you know, I wasn't over the moon about Rogue One. I had some issues with the construction of Last Jedi, so I was sort of in a tepid place with my fandom in terms of what I was expecting, and I could not have been more surprised with how I responded to the film and how I was just absolutely taken completely off guard by this. And as a result, I think it definitely magnified, you know, the sense of enjoyment that I had.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I may have been even a little more adamant in my disgruntledness about needing, like, yeah, this is not a film we needed. I just didn't feel like it felt like a film that I wanted. Like, you know, when I thought of Han Solo, I didn't think like there's so much story there I can't wait to see. And then of course, like you said, John, you've got all the production issues that are going behind the scenes, and it's like, oh gosh, here we go again, you know. But at the same time, you know, there was always a small kernel of hope that it would turn out well, at least. You know, Rogue One had some behind the scenes issues, and I love that movie. And so, and you know, I would say too, my response to Rogue One also left me more hopeful for the story films than I have been necessarily for the saga films. I also had some, you know, Last Jedi issues, which you can go back and listen to that show, or anything I've written about it or talked about it in Aggressive Negotiation with John ad nauseum. But I'm with you, John. It was the trailers that started to sell me that there was just something about them that caught my attention, that made the movie come alive to me in a different light. And it's almost like, I don't know, maybe it's just something about, you know, the Han Solo swagger started to come through in the trailers, you know, the feeling of a really good adventure story started to kind of shine through with those trailers. And so I went in relatively hopeful that it would be good, at least, you know, that I would think it was good. You know, I didn't know if I'd come out thinking it was great. But yeah, I mean, I was absolutely just flabbergasted with the experience. From the moment the movie started, I felt like I had a lopsided Han grin on my face. And the moment the movie ended, it was still there. You know, like, so, yeah, I mean, but I did not expect that. And maybe that's what helped. So I don't really know, but it sure was it was a rip roaring good time. So I couldn't complain about just, I don't know. Anyway, I just devolve into, you know, just lauding praise. I feel like, the review we're probably going to do here, we'll talk through the different characters. And I think through doing that, we'll get an opportunity to really talk about the whole film at large. But I wanted to start first and foremost with Han, the Solo. And I wanted to ask you guys specifically right at the beginning, I think everybody going in, first thought was, can Alden do this? So I wanted to ask you guys, does Alden Ehrenreich pull off the role?
The only criteria that I had for him was, don't try to imitate Harrison Ford. Play this role. Be Han Solo the way you would play Han Solo. I don't want to see you try to imitate Harrison Ford because you can't. The guy's singular. And I think actually just in the very opening moments of the film, I was immediately won over because I could tell that that was what was going to happen, was that he wasn't going to sit there and try to ape anybody's mannerisms. Although, of course, there are certain moments like when he holds the gun and fires that are, you know, very much meant to mimic famous poses that we've all had burned behind our retinas, you know, of Han Solo in publicity shots and stuff like that. But I mean, you know, that's throwaway moments on purpose. But he nailed it. I completely believed that this guy that I was watching was completely capable of becoming the person that I've known and loved for, you know, since 1977, where it's like, you know, I mean, Han Solo was the big breakout character of Star Wars. Everybody fell in love with him. And so stepping into this was huge, and actually playing it and claiming it as his own, I think that Ehrenreich deserves a lot of praise for it, because I think he pulled it off. And I, you know, I struggle now to think, was there any other way that it could have been done? And I'm still terrified of, like, would there have been somebody that would have tried to just play Harrison Ford? And so, yeah, I mean, I guess I'm gushing over him at this point, but he sold me. I want to see him again. I want to see Han Solo in another movie played by Alden Ehrenreich. And I think that's the highest possible praise I can give him.
Solo, a Star Wars sequel.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
That's a great name. I love it.
That's a good
Thank
one.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm glad that you said that initial part about it not just aping Harrison, John, because that was how I felt as well. I think that people like a Harrison Ford, I was telling our friend Bruce even, it makes me think of actors like James Earl Jones. You know, these are like the people we regard as some of the greats of all time in film and voice acting. And you can't just find another one of those anywhere. So I think that it's not really possible to just completely replace someone like that. I think that he had to kind of have his own style. But I think, too, I want to credit the writers for giving some good dialogue for Alden and not just making it a lot of one-liners we've already heard.
Yeah.
Like, I'm kind of glad they didn't bring back Scruffy looking, you know. But there were some moments in there where they would reword things like, well, I've got a really good feeling about this. Mm-hmm. That I liked, and it didn't just feel like it was mimicking old stuff. But he was completely believable to me too, and good looking. I'm going to throw that in there. You got to be good looking if you're Han Solo. You got to have that jawline. And I like that they reworked the uniform, even of, you know, like what Han Solo is usually dressed like. Instead of having the white shirt, he had the navy blue shirt. You know, and then they mixed it up and gave him a suede jacket. So it was a revived look, but still Han Solo. So, it, yeah, I thought he was brilliant. I loved it.
You know, it's kind of interesting to me because in some ways I almost think it, I'm thinking through the wardrobe. Just this is completely off the cuff here. It just came to me. But, you know, in this movie, he has a much darker wardrobe. And in the what we get in the original trilogy, you know, he is wearing that very clean white shirt, you know, that it kind of is a signaling that something is changing within the character there. And is about to make a big change, you know, for him. It's going to be huge. So I don't wonder if that was intentional. I was reading the Art of book and they didn't say anything about that, but I wonder if that was actually intentional to have him have an outfit that started off in a much darker place. And then kind of moves towards something that's a little, you know, I don't know. Anyway,
I mean, costuming, there's no accidental decision with costumes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so there, I think that they were trying to symbolize the character's journey? I don't think that there's anything that says that they weren't, you know, and I know that that seems like a dodge of an answer, but it works. Like you think about it and you're like, yeah, you know, he's coming out of it. The shirt is a wee bit dirtier than maybe it should be in the original Star Wars, but you know, it seems that he's having a hard time paying the bills, so you know that's fine. But
yeah,
like,
it's hard to get to the Tatooine laundromat, you know. So
why would you bother? Honestly,
it's like I mean, laundromat.
There's a lot of dust storms.
Yeah, it's the laundromat or the bar bill. I'm pretty sure he's paying the bar bill. Yeah. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, so, very true.
You know, when it comes to Alden, I do. You know, Christy, we talked about this with the Twi'leks of the Night, you know, ad nauseum, I think, wondering if he could get there. John, you and I talked about this too, you know, will he be able to pull it off? And I don't want to sound crazy, but he made me totally forget that Harrison Ford exists. And that's not, I'm not saying I don't love Harrison, I absolutely adore Harrison Ford. He's one of my favorite, he plays two of my favorite characters of all time, Han Solo and Indiana Jones. And then so many others down the line. So, but I never thought to myself, man, I wish somebody else would. I mean, like, Alden just embodied the character of Han Solo. And I never questioned that he was Han Solo. And I think to me, that's exactly what you want in a prequel movie like this. It's like the same way where I felt like Ewan McGregor, I didn't think about the fact that he wasn't Alec Guinness younger,
right?
I just believed him as Obi-Wan Kenobi. And so, you know, this is very much in that same realm. And I just think he does such a masterful job of pulling it off. And he's able to play all the nuance you need for the story we get here for Han really well. The pain, the betrayal, the... You know, the trying to put on a brave face, you know, all these things that you need him to be able to do. I felt like he just did in a way I couldn't have asked for, to me, a better performance. And yeah, I'm gushing here, but this is honestly how I feel. And, you know, I went back and I saw this movie four times because I had such a good time every time. And to me, one of the things that jumped out every single time was just how glad I was that Alden was playing the character, and I didn't even think about it being Alden. It's just Han Solo on screen, and that's such a great thing. When you're doing Solo, a Star Wars story, the last thing you want to be thinking about is, you know, is he real? No, he doesn't really feel like Solo.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, and the strength of that is, and I think, Christy, you said this, that, it, you know, about the dialogue and everything, it's writing as well. They knew not to just try to say, you know, oh, well, let's just give him a personality that's just sort of like a greatest hits. They actually put him in a place where he needed to develop that was different than where we've seen him before. And so you get the right actor with the right script. And I think, you know, I think also, you know, Alden Ehrenreich is... you know, a name that's sort of known going into it, but he's not well known. So there's not even anything additional about him that you have to slough off to buy into the character. It's not like a, you know, I'm not saying that they would ever cast him this way, but like, it's not like a Tom Hardy came in and played this where I'm going to be sitting there the whole time going, that's Tom Hardy playing Han Solo, who was played by Harrison Ford. They got a guy who's obscure enough that you're able to give him that blank slate treatment. What's going to be tough from my perspective, is when I see him in another thing, am I going to see him as anybody else? Or am I going to be like, that's Han? You know, like, that's, mm-hmm. which in a sense is sort of the curse that Harrison Ford was trying to fight against for many years and everything. So, but it's a good predicament to be in for an actor, I guess. You know, oh, darn, they're going to keep giving me paychecks. Yeah. You know, oops.
Right, like Zach Morris.
Right. Yep, yep.
Yeah. Sorry, I had to throw that in there.
What did you guys think about, you know, the way they started the movie with, you know, Han starting in this very, I'd say, Dickensian, you know, Han twist type story? You know, like he is the Oliver Twist type character who's, you know, serving an overlord who's making them all these children pick pockets. And like, how did you feel about that kind of being the starting point for our character and where he'd move forward?
I thought that it was a good place to start because you want him to go on a journey. I mean, he has to have a reason to want to leave Corellia, and still have some roots. So I think that it's a really compelling story because they also don't give you all the information right up front. I mean, I love a story where you're thrown right into the action and they explain later and don't just give me a ton of explanation in the script or anything. I did think that the Lady Proxima thing was a little bit meh. Just not super interesting to me that she was the leader. But I do have to say, and I've said to his friends before, that I have to give some credit to the creature work on her because she was gross.
Yeah.
Yeah, just creepy, gross. And I love the scene I think we're all going to be quoting forever now, when he says, this is a thermal detonator. And she goes, that's a rock.
No, it's not.
Yeah. You just made a clicking noise.
I just set it off. Yeah.
You know.
You made that sound with your mouth.
The thing is, I think that probably with the build, with going into the world and introducing, the way they introduced us to Han, I love the fact that there was sort of an overture at the beginning that was just showing him driving, letting me acclimate to the world and get used to it. It was a different way to start a Star Wars film, and give sort of like a sense of pace and scale and build. I loved Lady Proxima just because I think that she embodies that sense of whimsy that I fell in love with, that so many of us have fallen in love with Star Wars, of here's this big, ugly, gross worm creature that sounds like an evil grandmother. And it's like when I first heard her voice, mm-hmm. I was like, that, whoa, what? That was so weird. And I love weird. You know, it has very, very heavy shades of, you know, the cantina, the unexpectedness of it. And I thought that giving him that background was brilliant in a sense, because of the fact that, you know, when he runs off to join the Empire to get away, we know how evil the Empire is. And even Han knows how evil the Empire is, and nobody wants to be around the Empire, but you have somebody in this predicament, you can easily see them being desperate to leave. And it's such a different setup than we're used to, especially in light of like Anakin and Luke, especially Luke, who Han's going to meet later on. Luke has a nice farm family life that's quiet, but he's desperate to leave because he wants to see this big bad galaxy that's out there and be a hero. Han just wants to get out because life sucks and he wants nothing to do. I'll do anything to get out of here. And it's, you know, and it's interesting because it immediately puts those two characters on similar journeys for different reasons. And I think that's a very interesting way to approach it.
I did want to add one really cool thing that I forgot as well. The very first scene is a call to Han's mechanical skills, because that's when he's trying to create a spark to get the vehicle going again.
That's an excellent point.
And I forgot that's actually where it opens, is just the spark twice of him trying to get it started.
Yeah, that's a great observation. You're right. It is.
No, I'm right there with you. I think what the neat thing about doing this opening and telling this story this way and kind of using, you know, this Oliver Twist Dickensian thing is that you immediately know as an older audience member what's going on, right? You understand the story without them having to explain a lot of stuff to you, which is great. Using an archetype from literature to inform what you're watching is hugely important. So I think that's something that I just enjoyed because I immediately got the context of what's happening and why it's happening and all those things. And I thought that was a really smart way to get us into Han's story, give us a bunch of, like, we can imagine backstory without them having to do all that. Like you said, Christy, they kind of just drop you in and then they slowly put you into this position where you're like, you know, as an older viewer, we, as an adult, we get what's going on, and then our brain can fill in all this backstory for us without them having to do that work. I just think it's really efficient, smart storytelling, and I thought it worked. And I, John, I'm with you. Lady Proxima kind of reminded me of, like, all the stuff, from, weird Jabba the Hutt in Return of the Jedi to weird things in the prequels, weird beings we'd meet there, even just Boss Nass, something that's really off the wall and strange. And it's just, like you said, there's something strangely creepy and comfortable about it. Cause like you said, she sounds like a grandma,
yeah,
like an evil grandma, or your evil aunt Bertha or something. But, I thought all that worked. And then I thought too, we'll probably go back and forth now a little bit between Han and Kira because it's hard to talk about one without the other because so much of the story has to do with the beginning of this movie and where they start. But I also thought it was really smart at the beginning of the movie to have him be loyal to this one person, to have this one person in his life that he is willing to do anything for. You know, he's willing to sacrifice anything for, he puts her needs above his needs, actually. He would go back if he could, he would walk through that gate and pull her through the gate and take her, switch places if he could. Like, that's the kind of character, and I thought that was a great place to start with this character because it informs so much about why he'll be connected to Chewie. Why he'll do the things that he does throughout the rest of the movie, and it starts at the very beginning with him and Kira.
Yeah, well, I think there's also an important seed because I think that's something that's sort of grown about Han is that, people have come to accept that he didn't have a conscience except for Chewbacca. And I think that this beginning with Kira sets up the idea that no, there's a baseline there for him. He's already a caring person. It's that he wants to pretend that he's not, because Kira calls him out on it and says, you pretend to be, you're the good guy. That's who you really are, no matter what you're trying to pretend to be. And I like, this is something, Chrissy, I'll let you in on a little back and forth that Matt and I had previous to this. I think that the heartbreak of Kira, I think that Kira was a perfect match for Han for a lot of reasons. And seeing this, one of the things that I've always struggled with since seeing The Force Awakens for the first time was Han and Leia breaking up. That's like so weird. And I kept going back to it. I was like, I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense to me. I don't understand why they would break up. And because it's the fairy tale ending and everything. So along comes Kira and I suddenly understand. I don't think Han ever gets over this. Leia reminds him of Kira. She's similar to Kira and everything, but there's the one that got away. Go all the way back to, Citizen Kane, where, the guy's in the old folks home talking about, I never forgot about that woman in the white dress, that I saw when I was riding the ferry one day. He's like, I've lived my whole life. I had a happy life. I had, you know, wife and kids and everything, but I never forgot her. And I don't think that Han would ever forget Kira. And I think that that would be something that would be, you know, easy for him to wax nostalgic about when he has problems in another relationship. And so, you know, I thought that she added a lot to this story. And I just think Kira is so great that I want more stuff with just her. Like, I would watch a movie that's just like Kira, a Star Wars story. I'm like, on board. You got it. I am there. Or a book or any, to give me anything at all at this point. I want to learn more about this character.
I'm glad you made that point. And I do think it's probably 50-50 of also having Ben in the mix.
Child
that ultimately kills their parent is a pretty awful child.
I think that definitely was a hurdle to overcome as well. Yes.
Yeah. but I get what you're saying. I do think that it adds to that narrative of what's going on with Han later in The Force Awakens. And I think that it also even reminds me of if you read the Leia Princess of Alderaan book, about Leia's mindset when she meets Han after having her previous relationship.
Mm-hmm.
But I think definitely they've both been through now this heartache at a pretty good age where, you know, you're old enough to understand what's going on. And I think we all would like to see what's going on next with Kira, because where you leave it, my husband and I both had completely different viewpoints of what was going through Kira's mind when she says goodbye to him, or rather doesn't say goodbye, just flies away. I felt like it was her saying, I've turned and I'm going to follow Maul.
Mm.
My husband was like, no, I think that it was more that she knew Han was a good guy and wouldn't be able to stand up against Maul. So she was going instead to protect him.
I would be inclined to agree with him. I think that Kira is mm-hmm. protecting Han and, you know, wishing that she didn't have to or didn't wishing that she didn't have to make that choice. But,
she still wants to be with Han, but she feels like she doesn't have a choice.
Yeah.
Well, it seemed like one. I love you bringing up Princess of Alderaan because Leia is betrayed by her first love, but he's doing it for what he thinks are noble reasons. Mm-hmm. Kira is doing the exact same thing to Han. In fact, she's doing the exact same thing that Beckett was trying to do to Han at the beginning when he says, no, don't come with me. They don't know what you look like. You don't have to be a part of this, because if you come with me, you're in this life for good. She did the exact same thing with Maul. She sold Beckett out because she knew Han would probably take care of him, and that would be the end of it. And then Han, again, is protected, and, you know, she's the one taking the full responsibility, basically, and continuing to kind of fully immerse herself with, Crimson Dawn. But at the same time, on her character, I think the difference between the two is that the lesson that Kira has learned from all of her experiences is that the only way to get what she wanted, which was to be free to do whatever she wanted to do and not be told what to do by anybody, was to have power. And the lessons that she's learned in life is the only way to make it is to have more power. And there is no real winning in life. There's only surviving. And I feel like that's part of what she's doing as well, is she's protecting Han. She loves him. But she also wants to survive, and she feels like power is the best way to do that. At least that's what I was seeing in that scene. So it's very complicated. I think there's so much going on with that character. It's not just black and white with either of them. It's so much more. I think it's great. So
I agree. And as we've been talking about it, something that strikes me is they both, to get away from Corellia, went with a great evil. Han joined the Empire, and she went with Crimson Dawn. But I think what you see is Han isn't able to stay with it. Han is that good guy. He can't stay in the Empire. Mm-hmm. It's just not in his character. So I think it's even very interesting because Kira can be making this noble decision to protect Han and therefore go with Crimson Dawn. But much like Anakin, she's using a noble reason and motivation to make a bad decision for herself. And mm-hmm. so that's why I even want to see more with Kira after this, because she could go two ways. Christy, she could at this point say, okay, that's it. That's the last bit of humanity. Now it's gone. Like Ben is trying to do later. So if anything, it ties into Ben's thing. Like, and that's what's so fascinating about her character and about this film is on the one level, it's just this amazing 2-hour and 15-minute adventure where you're just having a great time. But here we are talking and it's like, oh, wait, well, no, this ties in with. And what a testament to the writing of this film that you can do that and peel mm-hmm. it apart like that. It's great.
And one other thing about Kira I've got to throw in there is props to the costumers. Mm. Because I want to make her dress that she wore on the yacht so bad. It's just gorgeous.
Again, we're going to be going back and forth between her and Han for a little bit here, so just bear with us. But she is one of the most complex characters I feel like we've had in Star Wars when it comes to who she is, where she's been. I think Emilia Clarke's portrayal to me was really well done. Mm-hmm. I thought that she played the part so well because there were those moments when you could really tell how much it was paining her to do what she had to do or what she felt like she had to do. But then other times, like, she's just an awesome action hero. When she runs out of the Falcon with those detonators and starts blowing things up and she's like, why are you all standing around? Like, it's just, she's a go-getter. Like, she is such a great character. And I'm with you, John. Like, I want to see more of her. I think there's so much that's happening there. And now with what we already revealed, the fact that it's Maul, the leader of Crimson Dawn, I think them working together just sounds like, this is why we need more. We need another Solo film because I want to see how this plays out with her and Maul. And of course, with Solo and Chewie and how they got to get wrapped up in this, you know?
Just because we have, gone into the full spoiler territory about Maul, I can also tell you that probably one of the things that made me fall so head over heels in love with this film was I didn't see that coming from anywhere. And when that hologram started up, I like sat up and I could feel my head cock to the side and I was like, wait a minute. No. Mm-hmm. And then like it went over and I saw, the moment when he's pulling the hood back, my family made fun of me. And I'm pretty sure there were people in the theater that laughed too. I literally shot out of my seat, like half standing saying, what? Like, I was so excited and happy about that. And you know what? If people want to call me a fanboy or something like that for that, I don't care. I can't name to you the last film, especially a big quote-unquote blockbuster-type film, that caught me so off guard that I had absolutely no inclination of this big surprise, and it just blew my mind in the moment. And it, like, I look for moments like that when I'm watching a film. You know, we're obviously in prequel territory. You know, one of the jokes, I know Han and Chewie are going to make it through. Sure, so give me some other surprises. And that one delivered in spades was like unbelievable. I was so happy because there's been this almost mystique or conspiracy theory or what have you that I don't think is necessarily supported. But in the Disney era, a lot of the fans who didn't like the prequels have sort of embraced that as an opportunity to say, well, we can disavow that now. We're in the Disney era. And for a film in the Disney era to bring him back and put him on the big screen, you can't avoid him now. He's there. You can't say, oh, well, that's just the cartoon. No, he's right there. and he's played by the actor who played him back in 1999. So suck it. He's there, and I knew he, yay, you know, I'm sorry. I get so excited about it. I still get excited about it, obviously. So.
I'm right there with you. I think that I turned to my wife when that happened because I don't even remember what happened. I was just so giddy with glee. Like, I was beside myself, the fact that they had done this. And it just makes perfect sense. Like, this is one of those moments where clearly they understand the time period they're in, what's going on in the galaxy, and kind of like with Rogue One, where they were like, we need somebody to be this leader of the Partisans. Well, the best person we've got for that is Saul. Don't make somebody up if you don't have to. Who's the best person to be this character in this movie? And John Kasdan said that he fought long and hard. He's like, no, it's got to be Maul. Ron Howard agreed with him, you know? And so I got to give it to him just by having the guts to go with Maul and say, yeah. And not only that, but I mean, it just made my little Clone Wars heart giddy too, because this legitimizes the Clone Wars in a way, like you said, John, you can't discount it now. It is, everything about it means something. And one of its biggest moments really means something now that Maul is back. And I just think, you know, it's an exciting place to be able to tell that part of the story, because we know where Maul is going to end with it, Rebels, right? But we don't know how he got to that point, and there is still so much. And here it's very clear that Palpatine has this alliance basically with these crime syndicates, so he's using what's going on for his gain as well as the Empire. So, like, it just creates a whole other layer of the story that doesn't have anything to do with Jedi and Sith. It just has to do with Palpatine's machinations. And to me, that's super exciting.
It is super exciting. And I had a friend who sent me a text message the morning after he saw it. And he said, oh, that wasn't Maul, was it? I said, oh, no, it's Maul. It's really him. And he's like, no, it's just somebody who looks like Maul or sounds like him or something. I was like, no, I assure you, my friend, it's Maul. You should go back and watch the Clone Wars. And so hooked him, and he's like, oh, well, I have to learn more about this. And I'm like, for more about the Clone Wars, go to your local streaming service and watch it at your convenience. Like, I was like, I can tell you episode numbers if you want, but yeah, that's him. Like, and that's been the consistent question that I've gotten from some casual fans out there. Now, my wife is a casual fan, but she lives with me, so she knows all about, you know, Maul and everything. You know, I don't shut up about it, but like, you know, I got more than one question of, I have a question about timeline now. Isn't Maul dead? Does this take place before? I was like, nope, nope, nope. And so I keep sending people over to the Clone Wars. I'm like, he's been alive for years. Trust me, it's the real guy.
So speaking of timelines, because my sister is a casual fan, I actually physically drew a timeline for my mom and sister.
That's awesome.
And I was like, well, this is where this is, and here's all the numbers.
That is awesome.
And my mom sent me a text back and goes, only a true fan. But yeah, I got that moment even before the Maul moment, because I don't know if anybody has seen my picture on Instagram or Facebook, but I cosplay Aura Sing.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so when Lando brings up, yeah, Michael was like, your face looked like an angry toddler. He pushed me.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure the fall killed her.
Yeah, but I loved that they just casually bring her up in that conversation between Lando and Beckett at the bar.
Yep.
And so that legitimizes something from Clone Wars and from The Phantom Menace. But it also, like you're saying, John, it raises the questions of people that don't know the whole timeline to go find the information and to watch Clone Wars and Rebels and maybe do some of the reading. It's really great to have all of this stuff tie in together and make it legitimized. And I feel like it's this party of Ron Howard, George Lucas, and Dave Filoni hanging out together. And I'm like, I am all for this. Yeah. Let's do it.
And the thing is, the best thing about these references, you know, people don't need to know who Aura Sing is, right? My wife doesn't know.
Right.
Oh, you killed Aura Sing. All you need to know is the context. Oh, this is obviously from the context of this conversation, you know, a heavy hitter that he took out, or, you know, saying
Lando owed her some money,
right? Or you know, we could have hired Bossk, and it's like, you know, for us, that's like, ha ha, tee hee. And even mm-hmm. the Maul thing, that still works because you know that there's somebody who's heading up Crimson Dawn. But, you know, to speak to that point you brought up, Matt, about Kazdan fighting for it, why not have it be Maul? Then you know, instead of introducing a brand new character in hologram at the last minute, bring in somebody you know is out there. And that way, like, the scene still works. And even if, like my friend, he says, nah, that couldn't be Maul, he's dead, I just, you know, it's just somebody who looks like him. Still neat. Still cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's the thing that this movie does so well, is that I think that it plays well for fans. Obviously, like, it they rewarded all of us who have been with the series for however many years and consumed all of these different things, you know, whether it was canon or non-canon sources. I mean, we could spend probably an hour just talking about all the little tiny connections that you can see in Voss's office alone, but we don't have that kind of time. But there are many there, and one is just Han Solo in The Last Legacy's Zim skull. It's right there for you. And it's on the cover of the book. So it's just those kind of little things that made it so great. One last thing I wanted to kind of mention, I thought was really interesting about Han Solo and Kira and together. I kind of got this, and this is what was so wonderful. I got this wonderful 1940s vibe from their relationship. 40s, 50s type vibe. And it reminded me so much. It was like a John Mellencamp song. You know, here's a ditty about, you know, Han and Kira. You know, and I really liked the way that worked together, because there's this old-time romantic sensibility about their relationship, right? Like, the beginning of the movie, mm-hmm. they're in love with each other. You don't question that they're in love with each other. And then things slowly drag them apart, even though they still love each other. But it's almost like this reverse Casablanca at the end for them, where, you know, she's protecting him and leaving, you know, and he's left there alone, you know, with his friend Chewbacca, you know, and it looks like the beginning of a beautiful friendship. You know, there's all of these like motifs that are happening throughout this movie, and that's just one. John, you brought up the idea of that Han gets his last name Solo because it's just like The Godfather.
Godfather Part Two.
Yes. When they get given the last name Corleone, because that's where he's from.
Mm-hmm.
So, Solo, he gets the last name because he doesn't have people. So Solo is a good way to put that, you know?
Yep.
It's these kind of things where George did that all the time. He was always referencing something in the Star Wars films, you know, and especially later on in the prequels and in the Clone Wars, he was always pulling an idea from cinema or literature and putting it in there and, you know, letting you find the Easter egg. And like you said, Christy, hopefully you'll go figure it out, you know, like, then you'll go watch Kira Star Wars films like I have now because of George Lucas, you know, or I'd watch, you know, old detective noir films because of Episode Two, or, you know, like all of these kind of things. Or you'd go read, you know, the old Camelot stories because that's what the romance between, you know, Anakin and Padme is based off of. Like, it's just, this movie did that too. And it created really strong characters for me because of it. Han Solo and Kira are two characters that I mean, I've never been a huge Han Solo fan. He's never been my favorite, but this movie brought him alive and brought her alive in a way that just, I'm just kind of want more.
Yeah. And I think it's an interesting echo because they have, you know, Woody Harrelson and Thandie Newton, you know, you see this sort of, dream in front of Han where you can see, like, he sees them interact, and there's this sort of, you know, there's this smile that he has that very much feels like this, you know, oh, hey, that could happen for me too. So, like, he is chasing the romance, and why that would be in his head of, oh, hey, I found Kira again. This is what happens now, and why it would be so heartbreaking for that not to happen after that moment. And, you know, even falling in with the crew and everything. It's so, like, this is such an interesting story of somebody who goes through, and who they are is just like everybody else in the, you know, in all of existence, shaped by those that they come into contact with by chance a lot of times. And you see all of these influences that, you know, construct him. And I just, you know, Kira is the baseline through it all, and his motivating factor. And it's like, I just, it works so incredibly well.
Really, honestly, we could talk, I think, for probably another hour about Kira and Han and their relationship and so much more. We just don't have the time. But I wanted, John, I think you segued us perfectly into Beckett and the gang. And what did you end up thinking about this character and his crew? You know, got Val and then Rio too, as a part of the gang. What did you guys end up thinking about how they worked in the movie? And I know too, it's important. Woody Harrelson is a character who sometimes it's hard to see him as anybody else but Woody Harrelson. So I wondered too, how did that work for you guys?
I really, I think I enjoyed Rio the most out of the gang, honestly, because he was just so rough around the edges at first, but then people kind of grow on him. So he's like, oh, I'm starting to like this guy, or maybe we could use some muscle, or he's got great quotes like, you'll never have a greater sleep than when you fall asleep in a Wookiee's lap. So I really like that character, I think, the best out of the three. But I like that Beckett is not just this tough guy that, you know, he and Val actually have a relationship, because it makes you feel an even stronger bond of what's bringing the three of them together than just, oh, he found two other random people or aliens. But I think that, of course, if you knew anything about Westworld, we all know it. Tandy Newton as Val, she really came in with a strong personality as an actress. And so she gave a lot of weight to Val as a character. Just somebody who really doesn't beat around the bush. She's all about business, and she only cares about Beckett and her crew, and that's it. She didn't trust anybody. So it does speak to Beckett that he trusts Han eventually and lets him and Chewie into the group. But still in the end, you know, ends up turning on him because he followed his own example of don't trust anyone. Everyone will betray you.
Yeah. You know, one of the criticisms that I've heard about the film is that Val, you know, dies so quickly and Rio dies so quickly. But I think even that serves a purpose story-wise of illustrating the type of life that it is that Han is getting into.
Yes.
That there's
so much this. Thank you for saying that.
there's an impermanence to it. And, you know, the moment where Val, you know, dies, I felt that. Like, I thought, you know, of all the moments in the film, yep, like, Woody Harrelson nailed that, like, that scream, like, perfectly. And also gave a window right into his character that he mourned, and then he stood up and was just, I just got to keep moving. There's no running. There's nowhere for me to go. I just got to face the music. So, you know, there's a very important lesson that he nonverbally transfers to Han on that of compartmentalizing things. You gotta, you know, you take your emotions and you just stuff them away because you just can't live with them, you know, it can't slow you down, as it were. You can't run away. You just gotta accept this life that you're in. And so I think that their deaths were early and they served a purpose of the gang. I loved Rio from the beginning. I always love the sort of quirky creature characters. But on my second viewing, I came around a bit on Beckett. And I think he's probably the character that's going to grow on me over time, whereas I start to pick up on more of those nonverbal cues that he gives. Because, yeah, I acknowledge freely that Woody Harrelson is not like a Daniel Day-Lewis type of actor where I forget that I'm watching him. But at the same time, he is a good actor and he knows his craft. And so I have warmed up to his character tremendously just in the course of two viewings. And it's not that I was cold to his character. I always liked his character. I liked his character from the get-go. But I think that there's more nuance to his performance that can unfortunately get a little bit lost because the rest of the cast is so strong. And some of his delivery is so subtle. You can miss it because there's so much other great stuff going on around him that when you go back and you start to sort of, you know, pay a little more attention to it, you're like, oh, wow, okay, that's why that scene worked even better, was because he did this or he gave this look. And he knows how to play that.
Well, and if you think about it, too, you're talking about the subtlety of certain actors, something that I'm reminded of is the way that Woody Harrelson as a person on a regular basis speaks, I think, to me, in this role cements even more that it's supposed to be like a Western.
Yes.
You know, that's to me how cowboys in Western movies would talk and address people, like, you want to live, Sparky?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, like that's perfect for that kind of story.
Yeah. And I do have to give him credit that the laugh line that got me that I love is like, you know, when he says the cannon's gone and he holds up his hands and goes, and I hurt my thumbs. Like, that's such a perfect moment.
I love
and it's
that line.
So comedically great. I love that moment.
Well, and I loved his little like moment with Chewie, you know, when they're playing the game and he's like, you can't swipe them off. They're holographic.
Oh,
you know?
And the fact, something that I absolutely love, is that Chewie gets beaten by the same move that R2 beats him with.
Yep.
I love the fact that, yeah, there's this little visual cue of like Chewie never gets better at it. And so I love that. Like you've instantly set up in that moment that Chewie's going to become obsessed with this game and never understand why he's not better. Like, you know, nobody can teach Chewie.
He's like, a stupid game. Yeah. I mess it up.
Exactly. Exactly.
Well, and I think the best part that I loved about Beckett and his gang, you know, Val and Rio, is that the way that they introduce Han to this life and they introduce him to the idea that you can't live this life alone. Everybody needs somebody. I loved Val saying that. She's like, everybody needs somebody, even this, you know, scoundrel, Beckett. Like, and they have each other. And that this life is, no matter how independent you are, you're gonna need somebody. And then Kira echoes that when she tells Han, go save Chewie. He needs you, but you're gonna need him even more because she's about to leave him. And she knows that he needs somebody in his life. And I thought that was just I'm right there with you, John, 100%. What they do with these characters, people forget that characters in movies are not just there for you. They're there for the characters around them in the film. They're there to tell the story for whoever is the protagonist. The protagonist in this film, the movie is called Solo, A Star Wars Story, not Beckett, Val, and Rio, A Star Wars Story. So the movie is all about how those characters are going to impact Han Solo and what they're going to teach him and what he learns throughout each individual experience with Beckett, with Val, with Rio, with Dryden, with Kira, with Chewie, with the Empire, with Lando, with L3, with Enfys Nest, all of these characters, they give Han an experience that continues to form him into the character which we have at the end of this movie, which will then go on to be the character we know from A New Hope, and then, you know, all the way to The Force Awakens when he's gone. And I think that's the thing that I felt like each one of these characters did a great job of informing Han Solo's character in a small way. And Beckett, you know, I loved their relationship because they do have this very father-son relationship. We get that conversation with Lando and Han, where we realize they don't have good role models in their life that are men. This is probably the best role model that Han's ever had and what it means to be a semi-decent human being and a man. And that's not saying a lot when you see Beckett's attitude towards life, but there is a loyalness that Beckett has, and there do seem to be some lines that he may not cross, and that's going to be something that, you know, I would love to see explored when they do another Solo movie, because there do seem to be lines that Han doesn't cross with the jobs that he might do. I think there's a lot of nuance going on here. And after seeing it a few times, I really was picking up on all these small little things that were happening between the characters and the group. And like you, John, pointing out, yeah, Han is definitely dreaming that Val and Beckett are going to be him and Kira one day.
You know, even the idea of togetherness and everybody needs somebody, you even find with Lando and L3. You know, like they're a pair. You know, there are these pairs throughout the entire film. And, you know, I mean, I don't know who to talk about first there, Lando or L3, because they're both.
I don't know. I think you should go with, I don't know, you mouthy scooch. Just hurry it up.
I'll tell you. Donald Glover was built up so much going into this film. Everyone was like, oh, Lando, you're not going to believe Lando. Lando's so great. You got to see Lando. And like, there's a lot that goes behind where it's like, watch out, guys. You don't want to build this up too much. But man, did he deliver. He did such a fine job. And the thing is, I thought there was, he was in dangerous territory at first, where I was afraid it was going to always stay at the I'm playing kind of Billy Dee Williams as he's been mythologized through his life. And instead, I think that Donald Glover also managed to make Lando into his own character and take possession of him over it. Do I forget Billy Dee while I'm watching? Yeah. Donald Glover was Lando. And, you know, again, it goes to the writing, but like, you know, the delivery is very important. You know, I don't like it. I don't agree with it, but I accept it. Is, you know, there are so many great moments that Lando has, but that's, you know, he's shot and he's trying to pull L3's computer out and the ship's on fire. And he says to Kira, my cape, that's a custom job.
It's like, that's what you care about.
Right, exactly. And what's so funny is, you know, there are two types of comedy you can kind of go for in these sorts of situations. And you have the, you know, and this is not a pejorative, this is a very good thing, the Guardians of the Galaxy comedy. Or you have this where, like, the comedy comes more organically out of the situations. It's not just a comedy movie. It comes out of the situations where you can see, you know, what it tells you about the character in that moment and the punchline that you're getting. And I think that Glover was just a particularly strong choice for, you know, the type of gifted actor who can walk that line as well. Mm-hmm. And also pull off that hairdo and facial hair, because not everybody can wear that and still look cool. So, you know, hats off to him.
He looks so cool.
He does.
He looks so cool. And I have to say, probably the funniest Lando moment for me was when he's like, The Calrissian Chronicles, Chapter 5.
Right.
I was like, oh my gosh, because he's like kind of doing a Kirk thing, and he's got the, you know, the Lando thing going, and he's telling the story from one of his old Lando books.
Yes.
And then like the whole thing there is just like, John, if anybody was going to read a comic about himself and it not be a joke, it's Lando Calrissian.
You're right.
Right. Like, he's so narcissistic. Yes! Of course, he's taking a break during a battle to finish his story.
Right. And the thing that annoys him is that his story gets interrupted.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, God, droid.
He's the Tony Stark of the Star Wars galaxy. There you go.
Yeah, that's a good analogy.
Yes. Instead of tracksuits, he really, really likes capes.
Yeah. But no, I love that they went so far to, like, he's got an entire closet full of capes. It's not just one or two. There's like 20. And that they really stretch this vision of, you know, Lando being this very self-involved, has to be well-dressed, has to win at everything kind of guy. It was perfect. And I do think that Donald completely became Lando. And I've loved him from previous acting he's done. But I love how smooth he came across, and the scene mirroring him meeting Leia with him seeing Kira was so funny. And then I think my favorite Lando moment, aside from the Calrissian Chronicles, was when he takes them to the Falcon and he goes, "Oh, what is that? I've got to talk to someone about this." Yeah. Like, I can't believe this has been impounded.
I do just tangentially want to share what I considered a parenting win was, you know, to speak to your point, Christy, about he's always got to win. The fact that he keeps the card up his sleeve. My daughter pointed that out afterward, and she's like, "I don't like that he was a cheater. I'm glad that Han beat him at the end." I was like, "Yay! That's a win. I'm willing to take that one."
Yeah, no cheating. Yeah.
Come on, John. Circumstances change.
That's true. So, that's true.
No, I mean, what can you say? Honestly, I don't think Donald Glover could be any more perfect. I feel like a little bit like Chandler from Friends. Could he be any more perfect? I mean, no, he couldn't. So what did you end up thinking about L3? Because I do have to say, I think she's probably the most unique droid that we've ever gotten to date in Star Wars, just because of who she is with her quest for, you know, the rights for droids. And the fact that if any droid is possibly sentient or their own being in Star Wars, it is possibly L3.
I like that they push that envelope of making her almost into that whole story of, you know, like Frankenstein's monster, where, you know, the creation surpasses the creator. I like that she kind of has this mind of her own. She's not just a machine that goes about her, you know, tasks. She decides to make decisions and has this banter with Lando like she's human. You know, when he says L3 is going to help us get there, and she's like, "I didn't make that decision." the one thing that I have seen said, and I do kind of agree with, was it was a little bit weird that they made the joke about her and Lando having a relationship. You know, I get the companionship level of just having someone else there to talk to, so you're not alone. But the whole thing, you know, joke about the sexual nature of it was, I feel like, just thrown in as like an awkward joke, just because someone in the writing room thought that would be funny. I don't think it was meant to be anything like to keep going further than that, or to give droids rights like that. Because at the end of the day, droids are still just machines, and that is physically impossible.
Oh, yeah, please.
No, I to speak to that, Christy, I agree with you that I think that, you know, the read I got from that scene where she's talking with Kira is that Kira is like sort of like flabbergasted because L3 has gone so far down the rabbit hole that she's hanging out and talking like like she's forgotten that she's a robot. And so it's you know, that's one of those things. I think L3 is a tremendously successful character, especially in terms of the Star Wars films, because I think that K2 sort of threw the gauntlet down in Rogue One, because he, you know, our image of the droid has been so cemented by 3PO, and K2 just sort of kicks that door open and is like, "Oh wow, there's there's real territory to explore here." And then I think L3 comes from a place of, okay, well, how are we going to be even more innovative and different and unique with this droid? And what's very telling to me, in a sense, is the episodes, they have BB-8. BB-8 is beloved. I love BB-8. I think BB-8's great. Mm-hmm. BB-8's adorable. BB-8 is cool. But it's in Rogue One and now Solo where you see more of a reflection of the times we live in versus the times we came from. Because at the time that Star Wars is created, you know, it's a mechanical engineering mindset to the world. The computer revolution hasn't happened. And so now these films are coming up in, you know, we've all become comfortable with basically the inevitability of an artificially intelligent machine coexisting with us. And if, you know, mm-hmm. or possibly, you know, wiping us out if Skynet gets its way. But like, I think that L3 reflects very much that different sensibility that we live in now. And I find it strange and compelling in a sense that, you know, Rogue One and Solo are the movies that are responding to that different thing and exploring it, whereas the droids in Force Awakens and Last Jedi seem to come much more from the early 80s tradition of droids, as it were. And the thing is, there's, you know, very much, you know, in the prequels, it's addressed, you know, even by Obi-Wan, where he goes, well, if droids could think, you know, like he's obviously like, no, droids don't think. So even with that, if you plug this film in, you see a march forward of droids becoming more human. And even 3PO goes on that journey through the original trilogy, you know, sort of like Mirror Anakin. You know, in reverse sort of thing. So I know I'm rambling at this point, but, you know.
I think it's something really interesting, too, because when you put together, like, Rogue One and Solo here, you're also left with these two droids who have mimicked the people that they are around, you know, and Cassian kind of frees K2, gives him a choice to be something different, and he takes that and kind of runs with it. And L3 has been given the ability to live this life by Lando, who won't wipe her memory because she has something mm-hmm. he needs. But in a lot of ways, it becomes a much more compatible, like a one-to-one relationship there. It's not like one is superior necessarily to the other. And so the way that you treat your droid, and of course, we talked about John before on aggressive negotiations, you know, if you're not mind wiping your droids either, they are going to begin to develop personalities and all these things. And they talk about a lot about this in Last Shot. So if anybody's kind of interested, there's a lot more about droids there that I found fascinating. And the kind of the limitations they have and how far they can go and everything. But I feel like one of the cool things about L3 is she does expand what it means to be a droid and how far you can go with it. And I think it creates a lot of fun. There were a couple of moments where I thought maybe it was a little over the top, especially when they're coming out in Kessel and she screams rebellion. And it was just like, there was a couple moments. But for the most part, I enjoyed her as a character, you know, when she frees that one droid and she's like, I don't care. I just need to use the computer. Give me some space. You know, like she's different. You know, again, like K2, it's a very different kind of droid, and it just made it a lot of fun because you don't know what to expect, and it's kind of nice to not know what to expect from a Star Wars prequel movie, right?
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, so, we've kind of talked a little bit about him, but I have to say, Chewbacca being more of a main character for the first time here was phenomenal. I really love the way they deal with Chewbacca. I love the characterization. Jonas gives him the ferocity of the character. When he rips that character's arms off, that's great. When he just is laying into people at Kessel, and he smashes that one dude's head into the ground to where, you know, if you picked that dude back up, he wouldn't have a head anymore. Like, it just, you really get the sense of, like, how powerful a character he is, like, how ferocious he can be. And I think it brought him to life in a way that we've never really seen Chewie brought to life before, and it was great. Like, it's everything I wanted from a movie that has Han and Chewie in it.
Well, and it shows you later what Han is referring to when he says, you know, I think it was in Empire where they were playing and he said, you're likely to lose an arm.
Yeah.
It made me laugh. And then, you know, you're getting to see that Chewie is not always just this cuddly bear who's your best friend. You know, he's a wild animal and he's going to stand up for, you know, his tribe. Or, you know, I like that moment too, calling back to the scene around the campfire when, you know, Han says he's can't find his family or tribe, but can't tell which one he said. And Beckett said, what's the difference? I thought that was great.
Yeah. And I will say, I will pay a lot of compliment right here. Similar to what I did with, you know, what we've all been doing with Ehrenreich and Glover. This is the first film of the Disney era where I was not conscious that that was not Peter Mayhew. Especially in Force Awakens was the first time where they didn't play it up pre-release. And I remember seeing it for the first time saying this, it's something different. This, you know, like it wasn't just the eyes. I was like, he's moving a little differently. I don't see what's happening here. And then in Last Jedi, Chewie didn't get a whole lot to do. So I didn't, I guess, really get to assess him fairly. But this was the first time where I really felt like I was just watching Chewie. I wasn't watching somebody else's Chewie. I wasn't thinking about how he was moving differently. And I think that's because he embodied, I guess, just his body language was adequately expressive of the Chewie that I expect to see on screen. So I think he was highly successful with that. And yeah, it's unreasonably important to me to feel
and
that
Jonas
way.
And Jonas can do some great Shriwook.
Yeah. Wait, he can?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Just him on camera out of the suit did it perfect.
Wow. I'm impressed. I'm really, really impressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I can't.
You know, the other thing that I thought was great was just how they met.
Yep.
You know, they really, obviously we know they're going to meet in the movie, but they do it in their own way. You know, they don't really do anything that we've gotten before in any of the, you know, non-canon legends material so much. They kind of create their own way for Han and Chewie to meet. It's such a great scene as, you know, Han starts talking Shriwook and, you know, then of course bad mouthing him and like they escape together and all that stuff. I thought that was really nice because again, we all want to know how this happens, but the fact that they just didn't do something that had been done before was great to me.
Although there is a very interesting echo, I think, of when Han gets tossed in the cell in Return of the Jedi. When he goes in and Chewie's sitting back in the dark and he just hears the it's like, Chewie, is that you? Like, I think that there is an echo there that's appropriate and nice.
And I don't know if you had the same thought I did, either one of you, but I at first was not thinking they were going to introduce Chewie yet in that scene. I was wondering if it was going to be a Rancor at first.
Oh, yeah.
Because they said the beast.
Right, right.
And I was like, Rancor.
Yeah, it would not have gone so well for Han if it had been like a baby Rancor, you know?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, I think, you know, the way they handled Chewie 2 was fantastic. I loved, you know, I have no idea how Han learned Shriwook or a little bit of it, the fact that he can understand it, but I just buy it. I think it was so much fun. And the characters had, you know, great chemistry together, you know, the kind of chemistry you want from Han and Chewbacca. And so, and of course the whole scene in there, you know, like, when did you become a pilot? 190? You look great.
Yeah.
You know, like it's just, it's funny stuff, you know, and those are the kind of moments that this is where I'm like, oh gosh, I really want another one of these movies because I want to see more of this building of that relationship because it was such a joy to watch.
And
like the shower scene.
Yeah.
Yes. Who knew in Star Wars we're going to get a shower scene between a Wookiee and a human?
But
and he's like, you don't think we could have done this one at a time?
My theater wasn't the only one where a cheer erupted when Chewie got in the co-pilot seat. Because, like, yes. I was both times. Like, there was this dull roar of, like, yay! You know, like, when he got in the seat. So, I think that was a great moment, too.
Something I'm interested to ask you about, because I know how one of you feels. But what did you guys end up thinking of Enfys Nest and her Cloud Riders? And then, of course, the reveal of kind of what they're trying to actually do.
So you're saying you already know how John feels?
Oh, I know how John feels.
Okay, then I'll start, and then I'll be interested to hear what John thinks. For me, when they first bring in that whole group during the train chase, I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was different, something we weren't expecting, to bring in a group and, you know, have Rio say, they're here to steal the score from under us. And you're going, okay, that's all the explanation I need as to who these guys are and what they're planning on doing. And that you can't tell if they're guys or girls or if they're aliens or human, you know, that you just see these suits. And so I think that it was interesting, but I think that, like I've heard another friend say already, the reveal of who Enfys Nest is didn't feel like we were ready for that point yet. It felt like it was supposed to be more drastic of a reveal than it ended up feeling to me. But I still like the direction they were trying to go with her. I like her telling the story of, we're from all these different cultures that were victimized and we're, you know, starting the rebellion. I thought that was awesome, because it's setting up for you. Okay, then Han is going to end up joining them later. But right now he's like, nah, not my thing. It just ended up feeling a little bit weak because of the way they set it up.
I had a different reaction. I loved it. I thought that it was, it was something that was unexpected, and therefore I the reveal really worked for me. I have a very strong and admittedly can be a little bizarre fetish about armor designs in the Star Wars galaxy, and like Enfys Nest's armor, I'm already pre-ordering whatever they're going to have Enfys Nest in as a toy or whatever.
Was it the helmet or everything?
Everything. Everything. We talked about, you know, Han's costume design earlier and everything like that, but like the Marauder's costume design, but especially Enfys Nest, like I just adore the look and the feel of that. Like I thought it was great. And to have them talking about starting the rebellion and seeing what I believe to be two partisans in there, meaning that these people are going to go on and join Saw Gerrera, like just even brings it, you know, I'm like, wait a minute, wait. So, you know, in a sense, it's this score becomes like a seed of everything that's going to lead up to Star Wars, you know, the original film. And like, I just think that's, I think it, because they don't wave it at you. They don't like flash it up there or anything like that. And I don't know whether it's backed up by anything, but in my headcanon at this point, I'm like, there are partisans in there, and therefore this is, you know, going to get to the partisans, which is going to tie into Rogue One, which is going to lead to the adventure that Han and Luke and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which I think is really, really pretty neat.
I am with you on this one, John. The thing that I was not expecting this to have anything to do with anything rebellion related. And where we are in the timeline, you know, again, I thought it was really smart. You know, you see Two Tubes there, who's, we know, one of Saul's partisans. And so whether or not he's already with Saul or he will be working with Saul later on, it lets you know that that's the road that these characters are on. This is kind of the very beginning of this. And, you know, not too far down the road, you're going to end up with, you know, the New Dawn time period where, you know, Hera gets involved and she meets, you know, Kanan, and all of these things are in this 10-year span between when this movie is and then when we get to A New Hope. And so the fact that all this is in the mix here, I thought was really neat. The fact that they would say these are characters here that realize there does need to be a change in the galaxy, and they are one of the small sects that will turn itself into a part of a rebellion that will continue to grow. And like, I wasn't expecting that. So the reveal to me was really cool. And just alone, they were so interesting as characters, the way that they played them out. You know, this is a Western. They have a very, Native American look to them in some ways, but then they end up turning out to be the good guys, which I thought was really cool. The Art of book talked about how this movie kind of plays its way all the way across the U.S. Like, if you start in industrialized New York in the 20s in Corellia, and you kind of find your way across the Rockies, and by the end of the movie, you end up at the desert on the beach, you know, in California. It works its whole way across, and they use that to their advantage in everything that they do design wise. And the Cloud Riders are just part of that. And the fact that they ride on swoop bikes, which kind of feels a lot like horses and everything, like all of it to me, I just thought was really clever and really well thought out. And I just liked it. I liked where they ended up with the characters in the reveal, because I was not expecting it to be a teenage girl, basically.
Well, and I also like the fact that you have a little pre-echo of Luke, of the teenager who is, you know, I'm doing this for a greater cause. Why don't you join us? And then, you know, Han saying, no, thanks, which is the same thing he initially says to Luke. And then you see here, just like I think that the relationship with Kira plays into what happens with Leia later, I think that him interacting with Enfys Nest here, you know, he's able to, years later, initially tell Luke no, but this probably plays on his mind as he's thinking about it and thinking, this is a second opportunity to make a difference. Yeah, you know, I'm not going to turn my back this time, that sort of thing.
Well, and what I wonder, too, is who is Enfys? Like, is she possibly from Onderon? I mean, because she had a look to me that almost seemed like she could be from Onderon, which would be really cool. So I just kind of wondered, you know, where her character is from. And would, if they do another film with Solo, would they kind of expound upon that at all? I think it would be kind of neat. If they never tell us who she is and that's all we get, I think it's fine. I don't need more. I don't have to have more, but the character is interesting enough to me, and so were her, was her group, that I would like to see. I would like to know more. You know, I feel like Starship Troopers, would you like to know more? Yes, I would. I will click there. Not only the fact that maybe, you know, connecting with Saul Partisans, Warwick Davis, you know, gosh, having him as one of her, main guys was just fantastic. And can I just say, before we get to this other section I want to go to, I love that we see aliens that we've already seen in Star Wars before. We got to see some freaking Twi'leks again, which is great. Mm-hmm. A Rodian. Like, we got to see...
That's what I was going to say. Like, I love
we got to
that.
See some aliens we knew, but then we also got new aliens. But it didn't discount the fact that, you know, there's this whole world of aliens that we've already used in Star Wars. Let's, bring Pikes to the screen for the first time. You know, all of those things where it's like, we're not afraid to embrace the Star Wars-iness of Star Wars. Mm-hmm. We're going to have joy in the fact that it's actually Star Wars. So we're going to give you a freaking Twi'lek.
Yeah.
And I do want to echo one thing from what John said. I'm not hating on them at all. I did still think they were cool. Just the reveal part was the issue I had an issue with. But I'm really big into the weapons, not as much the armor, but I looked up what weapon she used because it reminded me of the Riot Baton, and it's called an Electro Ripper Staff, which sounds so cool.
That is pretty awesome.
Well, and it also kind of reminds me of the staff that the guards have, the Magna Guards in episodes 2 and 3.
Oh, yeah.
Or episode 3. So, and then
I love those electro baton kind of weapons. I think those are so cool. Yeah.
I realized we didn't talk about Dryden. And I feel we would be remiss if we did not talk about Paul Bettany's character, because I felt like he is the perfect man to play this character, the one who so smooth, and yet, man, he is the last dude on Earth, or at least you think until you know who he's working for, the last person in the galaxy that you want to make angry, because he just doesn't suffer fools.
No, he seems like one minute he's just like, are you hurt? Are you okay? And then he's like, what do you mean you don't have the goods?
Yeah, I enjoyed him a lot. I thought his character was very interesting. I love the fact that they gave him those scars on his face. A part of me will forever want to see the lost footage of Michael Kenneth Williams in the role, because that intrigues me, because I'm a big fan of him as an actor. And in a sense, I'm kind of heartbroken that he has been cut completely. But all of that being said, I mean, Bettany and Howard have a history together, and they've worked together. So like, it makes perfect sense that Ron Howard is going to call up somebody that's like, you know how I work. I really need you on this one. And Bettany's like, yeah, I gotcha. And you know, so yeah, I enjoy his character a great deal. I actually thought that the way that they played the fight, you know, between him and Kira was great. Like, I completely, yes. That's how I knew the character had completely sold me, was I was completely invested in those moments. And I think it's a real testament to him as an actor. I mean, so many great performances in this film.
And he also gets great weapons.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those are pretty great. Yeah.
Not to play it off as silly, but I mean, he has like these double-ended gold daggers that he's throwing around, and it just looks amazing. And then I've already seen people sharing the gif of when he and Kira's weapons meet and that spark.
Yes. Yeah.
It's just like a lightsaber battle would be.
Yep.
Just with different weapons. So I like that we kind of still get that payoff, even though there's no lightsabers really in this movie. I think that Paul Bettany is incredible, that he's done Infinity War and then now this as well.
Yeah.
He's done so many things I love now. I mean, gosh, I remember him back from A Knight's Tale.
Yes.
He's so good at playing a villain or a comedian. And I like that even my husband and I noticed that in this role, Dryden, the more he gets angry and agitated, the more his scars darken in their red color, and his eyes even got more bloodshot.
You're right. Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
So I don't know if he was supposed to be like alien or if they were like scars. Because, I mean, we even noticed his thumbs. He had pointed thumbs, but the rest of his fingers were regular, like human fingers. So I don't know if that's like in one of the books or something, but I'm going to look that up.
There's got to be some interesting history between him and Maul, I'm willing to bet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Maul yes. made him earn his spot, as it were.
Well, and the fact that, you know, he has a Sith holocron in his mm-hmm. office. And mm-hmm. the fact that he has a desk that is made out of the block of obsidian actually comes from a Sith Lord's castle.
I didn't know that.
Yes. And I'm trying to remember who the Sith Lord is. It's like, it's Exar Kun.
Oh, my gosh. That's a callback. Yeah. Good grief.
That's where his desk, the obsidian comes from. So like, I thought he plays this character so well, this kind of, he's the classic gangster who he is not afraid to get his hands dirty, right? But the first face he shows you is one of friendship and loyalty and all of that. But the minute you disappoint him, it's a completely different person. He's almost like bipolar in that way. And I think it's great. You know, like, I think he just did the part service. And again, he's referencing, I feel like the character itself is just referencing all of these great mob films from the past, you know, with characters like this. So the homage that they do here to all of those type of films is fantastic. I wanted to ask you guys about this because, you know, something that I will say, ILM's work hasn't been as stellar as it had been in the past with some bigger movies that I'd seen, whether it was Black Panther or Infinity War or, you know, even The Last Jedi. Some of their work did not look as what I expect. But I've seen this movie four times, and there is absolutely never a moment in this movie where I'm pulled out by going, oh, that doesn't look good. Every part of this movie looks phenomenal effects-wise and production-wise. I just feel like there's something about, and I felt like the same thing with Rogue One. Like, these story movies are bringing the best out, and maybe it's just because they're really challenging ILM to do something really different. I mean, doing a train going along a, you know, massive, you know, Canadian or American Rockies mountain pass, like that's a whole new challenge. You got to be excited to try and pull off and make it look like, you know, you're actually there. So to me, this was some of the best work that they've done in years.
I think that the issue in a lot of the big budget releases that have come out has been consistency. Like, you can sort of tell when they've had to farm it out because of workload and stuff like that. And, you know, and the thing is, it's like, it's, you know, I wouldn't have even thought about that type of stuff when I was a kid, but it's the world we live in. You know, like when Infinity War has this great effect of Thanos crying, and I'm like, oh my gosh, it looks real. There's a giant purple man crying. I can't believe what I'm watching. And then I see a big battle scene with people running across, and it looks like somebody just sort of like, you know, held Bruce Banner's head on a stick as they were, you know, running down. And it's like, well, that doesn't seem, they got somebody else there. So like, I would say the consistency and time pressures, I almost wonder if, because this is something that I was wondering before I saw the film, I almost wonder if they might have benefited in a sense from some of the director tumult that happened, because, you know, you come in and you start working on the thing, and they've storyboarded everything, and they started working on stuff. And I have a very strong suspicion, absolutely nothing to back this up, but it would strike me as common sense for any director who had been hired to say, okay, we're not changing any of the effect. I'll shoot around what you're working on because I don't want to mess with anything. So I wonder if maybe there was that opportunity there. But regardless of the reasoning, this is some of the best effects work I think I've seen in years, in terms of consistency, but also in terms of, I mean, Rio looked photoreal. Like, I was sitting there staring at him the second time I saw it, you know, like trying to figure out, I was like, well, was this a puppet where they just animated the face or something? Like, it looked like a real four-armed monkey jumping around everywhere. I was like, this is unbelievable how real this looks. It was crazy.
Yeah, for me, it was the most apparent how great of a job ILM did with things like Rio, with the hounds in the beginning.
Yeah.
That are barking at him from the speeder as they're racing toward the, you know, port. And then even when they're running around trying to find Han, they look so realistic. With Lady Proxima at the beginning. And then, you know, the other effects with all of the ships and stuff as well. I love the spin in the speeder Han is using at the beginning.
His Corellian drift moment.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. I want so badly for that to be a ride at Galaxy's Edge.
That would be pretty
It's
awesome.
Like a new bumper car ride.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm exactly. Or you could make it into like one of those 4D rides like they have at Universal Studios, like the Transformer ride.
Yes. No, you're right. That would be a great ride.
John's all for that now that he lives in Orlando.
Oh, really?
Build what you want, guys. I'll ride it. That's the pack that I have down here. Absolutely. No, I love that idea, though, Christy.
John will ride.
No, no, no. Seriously, I love that idea so much. I hadn't even thought about that as a ride, but you're right. Like the Transformers ride sort of thing and like going through like that.
Yeah.
Oh, please. Somebody is listening to this who knows somebody at Disney. Throw the idea out there. please. And
I will say that is what was Michael and I's bread and butter when we got to go to Universal for the first time.
Oh yeah,
was we rode the Transformers ride, the Spider-Man ride, and all the Harry Potter rides, and they had a lot of that kind of thing where you're indoor, but it's like an indoor roller coaster.
Yeah, dark rides are. You know what? We could easily go down a very strange rabbit hole
I
here.
Just wanted
but
to
yes,
throw it
no,
out
that. Yeah, I'm with you, and we can table that. Maybe we can have a 602 club later on about, I don't know, theme park movies.
We'll do
or
a supplemental
something.
About
Star
theme
Wars
parks.
Rides we need.
Yes, I like this idea very much.
So I just, you know, just wrapping up this little section now, I really have to say, you know, it was phenomenal to see a movie and a Star Wars movie that everything looked great. You know, and like you said, John, there was just such consistency across the board that I never questioned anything. You know, that I'm still just drawn back to the train sequence and just how good that looks, you know, from the battles they have, from them, you know, trying to uncouple things, from, you know, the battle between Beckett and Emphis Nest when she jumps off her speeder and lands on there and just starts like wailing on him. All of those things, just, it was so good. It's so good. And it's one of the things I think that I felt like this movie did so well is it just made it such an immersive experience. And because I never questioned anything that was happening like that, because there was such consistency with the work, I had such a good time in it with that. You know, like that, there is something to be said for just having consistent effects work to help you never leave the moment, but always be in the moment. So the last thing I want to ask you guys about, obviously with a Star Wars movie, it's a big deal to have a new score. And this time, John Williams wrote the Adventures of Han theme. So he created that theme, and then John Powell came in and created the rest of the score. So we got a theme for Chewbacca. He works in the Solo theme. He's got an Emphis Nest theme. He's got a beautiful love theme. He's got action adventure stuff. I mean, what did you guys end up thinking about how this works for the film?
I think that it really works very well because, like you said, Matt, it creates this immersive experience where they're bringing in someone new, but they're still reminding you of John Williams' pieces as well. I think that the only time that it really stood out to me and caught me the most was when Han is on the ground, both in the port scene where he's trying to get out of Corellia, as well as when he's on the ground as a, you know, in the infantry with the Empire, they play the Imperial March. And that catches me because I'm dark side at heart.
Hence being worse.
Definitely. Definitely not a rebel. And so it stood out to me and reminded me of the things that I love from the original trilogy, Darth Vader all the way. And then still had these new things. Like, I think that it built such great tension in the scene on the train, having choral music, because it's such a buildup. You know, the pitch gets higher and the volume gets higher as you're seeing that Val is about to push the button. And then it really, the rest of the time, I felt like it fit so well with the action that I've said this probably before to you, Matt, that it didn't jump out at me. It just flowed and it was perfect. I think that he did it justice.
I don't know that I can really add anything to that, Christy. I completely agree. I've been listening to the soundtrack pretty much nonstop for the last several days. I'm absolutely hooked on the track Reminiscence Therapy because it does what Kiner was able to pull off when he needed to in Rebels, which was to lift sections of original score. And, but rework it in such a way that it becomes its own thing. And so it's a callback, but without being overbearing. And I think that also there is a regret on my part that when the Imperial March hits, when you first go to Mimbin and Han, you know, the explosion and everything like that, I love that music cue so much, and it's not on the soundtrack. So I already want an expanded score released. I don't know if we'll get one, but I already want an expanded score. And that, I think, is probably the highest compliment I can pay to any score is when I purchase it. And I'm like, no, I want more of this. I want more.
Yeah.
A couple of things, really. I love the flying with Chewie. I love that the theme that they create for Chewie. It's so fun and vibrant and kind of beautiful, you know, and adventure filled, and like I really enjoy that. Strangely enough, too, on the soundtrack, I really enjoy the what they call "Chicken in the Pot," which is the song that's playing when they go to Voss's ship. I think it's so fun and noirish and kind of like sexy jazz feel. It's perfect. I have to say, though, the track that's really getting me recently is "Testing Allegiance," which it has a robust beginning to it. And then it moves into this almost like an affair to remember, longing, romantic feel as Han and Kira basically say goodbye. And it's just, it's so beautiful. And it so reminds me of those classic romances from the 40s and 50s that I grew up watching with my parents. That I love it. I love that so much of this music reminds me of classic Westerns I grew up, John Wayne films, about those Cary Grant movies, the adventure movies that I grew up watching, as well as Star Wars. And you put all that together, I think John Powell's done something that I'm really surprised in, and he's giving me a Star Wars score I just absolutely can't get enough of. So, yeah, I love it. But guys, you know, I know it's for all of us as we're recording this, it's starting to get late, and I appreciate you so much for kind of diving in big time with Solo. And honestly, I really hope we get to continue the discussion more on the Babel Conference, because there's so much more that we can talk about. But it's time to get down to Dryden's brass knuckles and see where you guys fall with Solo. So, Christy, if you're going to rate Solo, where are you going with this one?
So, I already know where I am with this one. I am at a 9 out of 10 Electro Ripper staffs.
Nice.
Yeah, I had to use that one. Because there was hardly anything at all that would take points off for me. I mean, it was a darn near perfect film to me in every way. Like I said, the maybe one thing I would take off a little was, for me personally, the buildup of Enfys Nest was not really there. And I meant to say the name didn't really jive with me that great either. When I first heard it, I went, Infant's Nest? What is he saying? but I thought she looked cool. I loved the actors that they chose, even though in the beginning, with casting, I was a little concerned about having Woody Harrelson playing himself rather than becoming a character. And of course, I think we all were kind of hoping that Alden Ehrenreich would end up becoming the Han that we wanted him to be. And I felt I got that. And then having Donald Glover, and then having Emilia Clarke as a Game of Thrones fan as well, that was huge. And I feel like she's so great at becoming a character. I didn't feel like I was watching Daenerys Targaryen. I felt like I was watching Kira. Like I said, 9 out of 10 for me, absolutely. I would see it a million more times.
I see Star Wars 500 times!
I think it's pretty obvious where I'm going to fall with this. Just to stick with the typical, you know, 5-star, 4.5 out of 5 Maws. I had so much fun. And it's something where as I revisit it mentally, I get even more out of it. I think that it is a nearly flawless film in terms of writing and performance and execution. I readily acknowledge it's not perfect, but it's damn near it. And I can say without hesitation, and this doesn't take away anything from anybody else, naturally. This is the best time I've had at a Star Wars film since the Disney takeover. This is the most satisfied I've been with a Star Wars film since 2005, which is the highest praise I can possibly give it. And like I am, as anybody that has had the misfortune of listening to me over the years knows, I'm Mr. I don't like physical media, but sign me up for the 4K UHD extra special steelbook collapsible box full of hyperfuel edition of this, because I will pre-order it today.
They need to go with that, the hyperfuel edition.
I'm on board. Mm.
That's what they need to call it.
Yep. Sold.
I love what you said there, John, that it's damn near perfect, because as you were saying that, I was like, John, say it. So yeah, just say it. Just go for it. Because it absolutely is. I've been telling people, this is the Star Wars movie that we never knew we always wanted, because it is everything I never knew I always wanted in a Star Wars film. I never thought I wanted a Han Solo film, but it completely sold me. It won me over time and time again, so that the grin, it literally never left my face. And that is not hyperbole whatsoever. I just did not stop smiling the whole time I saw this movie the first time. And I have enjoyed it immensely every single time that I've seen this movie. And I plan to go see it again this Saturday. That's how much I'm loving Solo.
Nice.
And like you, Christy, it's the performances. I think Kira has become one of the most complex and well-written female characters in Star Wars, next to Ahsoka and Asajj Ventress. Yeah. I don't think they're... I mean, she's one of the top now for me. She's fantastic. Alden Ehrenreich's Han Solo, the biggest compliment I can give them is I want more Han Solo films. You know, I came out of this movie thinking, man, I really want another one of these, because it's that good. And so, absolutely, 100%. I'm with you, John. This is 4.5 out of 5 malls, because, well, you know, he had that one half that got lost. So,
nice.
And I have had the best time getting to sit down and talk with you guys about it. I hope that people will talk to us over on the Babel Conference. Let us know what you think. Hit us up on Twitter. You know, just let us know what you're thinking. And if you liked the movie too, go see it a few more times and bring friends. You know, like, this is that kind of movie you want to bring friends to and experience together, and then sit around for a few hours and talk about all the things that you loved about it and the connections you saw, and just have a good time. Because honestly, I've been saying this too, this movie made me feel like I was back in the 80s watching the original trilogy and Indiana Jones again for the first time. That's how good this movie is. It brought back those vibes, you know? Mm-hmm. Anyway, thank you so much for checking out the show and listening. I want to say thank you to Ken Tripp and Davis Grayson. They are the reason that we're here. They're associate producers here through Patreon. This is a huge network, Trek FM. We have too many shows to make this come to you all by ourselves. And so go over to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can help us by being part of the team and supporting us every little bit a month. Honestly, every little bit a month actually helps. It makes a huge difference for this network. So again, that's patreon.com/trekfm. Now, Christy, you are just a massive bundle of joy and energy on social media, and you're doing so much these days with fandom. Where can people find you if they want to catch up with you?
Thank you so much. That's such a high compliment. If people want to catch up with me, you can find me co-hosting Galactic Fashion with my friend Teresa Delgado. We talk about Star Wars fashion first and foremost, but we also talk about other geek fashion items. So you'll want to hear about that at Galactic Fashion Pod on Instagram and Galactic Fashion on Twitter. And you can email us galacticfashionpod@gmail.com. And then you can find me personally on Instagram and Twitter as well at Bespin Bell, which perfectly relates to this movie.
That, I mean, it does. And let me just say, too, if you are a female and you kind of want to see what's out there in galactic fashion, Christy is always doing a great job of kind of modeling all the new things coming out from her universe and whatnot. So make sure you're following her, because not only will she have a great conversation for you, but she'll light up your life with an awesome new dress that she's wearing. So just saying. Yeah. And we're waiting for you to you know, we're going to put hold you to that, the Kira dress. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah, Dragon Con, I expect it.
I have a seamstress. I'll get to work.
Now, John, where can everybody find you, you lovable bundle of joy?
No. If Christy is the bright sun, I'm the werewolf
curled
under
up
the bridge.
In John's lap.
Yeah, right. Well, you know, despite the... whatever. You can find me out there, actually, on Twitter as Kessel Junkie. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig, which is a little comedy show. We get a little risque from time to time. No, not really. It's just two people undercutting each other all the time. And then you can find me over on the Nerd Party Network co-hosting Great Shot Kid with the inimitable Mike Schindler. And co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with the one and only Matthew Rushing, if you can believe that. He's a nice guy. I like him. I like talking to him.
He's got a cool name.
Yeah, he does.
I don't know. The guy's kind of a mouthy scooch himself.
So. Yeah, but he's no Moof Milker. So.
That is true. No Kashiki and Moof Milker. Not at all. Well, you can find me on Twitter, MattRushing02. I'm on Instagram under the same name. I am here on the network talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine with Chris Jones over on The Orb. I'm also on the aforementioned Nerd Party Network, Aggressive Negotiations, plus Harry Potter podcast called Owl Post. I do that with Drea Kaufman. It's really fun. We're walking through every single chapter of the series together, and we're in the middle of the Goblet of Fire. So great time to catch up with us with all the back episodes and then read along with us. It's a lot of fun. And then last but not least, I am doing a show called Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney, and we talk about films through the lens of faith, and we actually just released our Solo episode as well, talking about all the deeper themes that we saw in Solo, which a real blast. So I hope that you will check that out if that's something you enjoy. But thank you so much for joining us. May the Force be with you.